I think you can land on something. You can make something one day that's just like such. You're just like capturing magic in a bottle, and like you might never capture that magic again. But like if you're there in the room and you helped an artist make it, even if it's a one hit wonder, you're gonna get paid.
Hi guys, quick one from me. This is such an insightful episode with the music manager. You're going to want to stay tuned because we talk about the mind-boggling number of songs released on Spotify every day. What goes into a music publishing deal, the typical percentages involved with publishing deals, and so much more. And guys, if you've been liking the content, please make sure to like, subscribe, and share. It does wonders for the channel. Now, back to the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the music manager, Mark. How you doing, bro?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Welcome to the show.
It's good to see you, man.
Yeah, good to see you too. We like to start with a little icebreaker. What did you want to be growing up?
I didn't have any like big intention that when I grew up, like when I was young. I didn't have like, I want to be an astronaut. I don't think anyway.
I'd
honestly have to ask my mum or my dad. I don't know. I don't know if I said anything like that.
Not firefighter, doctor,
probably
footballer.
I can't even remember. I'm sure footballer, yeah.
Fair enough. Well, typically at this point I say, well, you wanted to be this and now you're a music manager. But maybe you wanted to be a music manager and you are. Briefly talk us through your journey to this point.
My journey to this point. Wow. So I started in music, or in some capacity in music, doing videography and photography. Mm-hmm. So like early on, me and my friends had a YouTube channel. We started filming artists locally, kind of in the same vein as what SBTV and Link Up and GRM were doing at the time. And then met a few people, started expanding that out, filmed some bigger acts. And then from there sort of transitioned into management once I realized that I wanted to be a bit closer to the artists and the process, and like being involved in like the actual music making and a bit more of the core of it, rather than being like an outsider looking in. Mm-hmm. Be a bit more on the inside, dealing with stuff and you know, protecting artists and working with them and on their visions and stuff. Not artists, but creatives, I think, generally.
Yeah, I get that. And you touched upon the fact that, you know, you were filming stuff. First question is like, how young were you when you started filming these artists?
It was probably like late teens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was this in conjunction with you like going to university? Was it?
Yeah, just before uni. And then when I started going to uni, things started like getting busier on that front. So I went to uni in Coventry. So I was like back.
Oh, the COV.
Yeah, COV. So I was like back and forth from Cov to London a lot. But to be honest, there was like a lot of us involved. There was like six of us involved. So the load could get shared quite well. So it wasn't like me being away was a big, big thing. It was just like whenever certain things came up, I would step in. Like I remember filming the Mobos in Liverpool one year, and I was in Coventry already. So that was an easy one.
Yeah.
You know, but
And I suppose the question I wanted, you know, you said you didn't really have a dream like growing up. Like, did you always have a passion for music? What was it that made you get into that initial, you know, filming phase to understand that this is something that you wanted to do? Where did that come from?
I think my passion for music, I feel like maybe some people have it younger, but I feel like a lot of people's, not passion for music, but their taste in music gets developed in like, maybe when they're like 12, 13, around that age, when you start to become a teenager, because I feel like until that point for me, I was just like sort of, I just like enjoyed music that was around or like that my mum was listening to or whatever. I'd just be like, my mum would listen to like Dido and like Texas. And like, so I was like, yeah, Robbie Williams. I loved all that shit. So, yeah. But then like probably around 12 was when I discovered. And also it was like, this was like LimeWire era as well. And then me and my cousin Monroe, who's been on the show before, we just got really passionate about music and we're just like, we trade CDs and like listen to stuff, find out about things and like just cover a lot of bases really. Like we got really into hip hop and like this, and then also there was the emergence of grime at that time. This was like 2002, 2003. So it was like,
a while ago.
When we were like 12 or something. And then, so it was like early Dizzy. It was like some pirate radio sets, but a lot of like hip hop mixtape cuts, a lot of like hip hop albums leaking on LimeWire, download them. Remember like, a lot of like 50 Cent mixtapes, Eminem, just that whole era, Dre, Snoop, that was like the my entry point into hip hop, and then kind of expanded out of there and then beyond hip hop into R&B and like other genres. Yeah.
Okay. So,
but like for sure, like got so passionate about it. Me and Monroe, like for sure.
Yeah.
Deeply right. embedded.
So yeah. in your teens is where kind of you found your passion for music.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, you started recording, then you went to university. What did you study at university?
I studied business management.
Yeah. Okay, I thought you was going to say music.
No. Honestly, I didn't know. When I finished school, I didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. Mm-hmm. I don't think I saw music as like a viable career option at that point.
100%.
I don't think I saw like... I didn't see it in front of me. Like I didn't have any family members that were in music or any like family friends that were in music. It was just, I didn't even know that that existed, like yeah. that a job in music existed. So I kind of just didn't even think about it. Like I think in my mind, I wanted to do something a bit creative, but I think maybe I thought it was like marketing or something like that, that I was probably veering towards. And then when I went to uni, it sort of bought me the time to figure out like what I wanted to do and what I was passionate about. And like, just open my eyes to more things, to be honest.
So the business degree that you did at university, mm-hmm. do you feel like it helped to equip you with skills that you've used, you know, moving forward in your jobs?
Nah.
No shade, by the way,
nah,
COV.
Not at all, really? Not at all. I don't think any job that I've ever gone for in my life in music, no one's ever looked at my CV,
wow.
ever. Like it's really done nothing for me. I wish I just got to the chase, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like I say, it sort of bought me some time. Mm-hmm. So it was a blessing in that sense.
And yeah, I mean, I think you do a lot of growing up at university outside of like the degree. But coming back to it, you mentioned the fact that, you know, there wasn't anybody in like your family or anybody who exposed music as a viable option. That talk me through the moment where you realized that music could be a viable option, and what was like your first foray into kind of working in the industry?
I think it was a couple of things. I think like after embedding myself in music for a long time, I started to realize like, okay, there's these A&R people that like put records together, and like artists need managers and things like that, and started to explore it a bit. Like I would always look at credits. Like I like looking at credits on albums. Like I would look through like the producers, the songwriters, even what studio it was recorded in sometimes, things like whatever information was there. And like, you know, I started to Google some of it. It was pretty early on them days on that, with that information being online. But so I guess I started to get a feel of it. And then when my cousins started making music, when Monroe started like producing for people, I think I just had like a desire to like, just to help him and like see where he needed help, what areas I could fill, what value I could add. And then from that, like meeting people and then being like, oh, this person's a manager, this person's a PR person, and figuring out what the roles are, just opened my eyes to it a lot more. And then from then it was just like figuring out how I connect the dots to get my foot in the door, really.
Mm-hmm. So on that, two things I want to dive deeper into. The first would be, you know, for anybody who's in a similar situation to you right now, what would your advice be to them to, if they wanted to learn more about the different pathways they could take in music, if not actually creating music?
Well, I think there's so many roles out there. Like there is a role for everyone in the music industry if you're passionate about it. I think that's the core principle, is being passionate about music and like having that drive to like want to add value to whoever you work with, whether it's artists, whether it's producers, songwriters, mixers, whoever, across the creative spectrum of music. So I think it's just about finding the information online, finding out what you might be good at, trying things, reaching out to people, trying to create opportunities, just trying to reach out to people and have a coffee with them. You know, like I did a lot of that and like tried and failed a lot of times. Like people are busy, so you're not always going to get someone that's like, oh, okay, I'll give half an hour to this kid that's probably not got anything to offer me, but I've got a lot to offer them. But shoot your shot and see what happens. And also just like build on the importance of building on your level as well. Like not, I think when I first got in the music industry, even when I was like an assistant, I was so keen to like, I want to meet the president of the label and the people highest up the totem pole. But like someone told me at one point, like you need to make sure you're good at networking sideways, because in the future, like you and your friends and your peers are going to be in those positions. Like you're going to be running the industry. So it's important to not neglect people that are on your level and build like with people that are on the come up with you. Mm. I think that's really important. Like,
Networking sideways.
Trust me.
We don't clip that.
Yeah. Network sideways. Like you never know where people are going to end up. Like I've got friends now that I've known for a number of years in the music industry that are, you know, starting to build into some prominent positions, and we're all able to help each other out and get on the phone to each other and link up and like offer advice. And like I've got a kind of collective of managers that I trust and that I can call up and be like, just be like open with, like, I've never seen this in a contract before. What does this mean? Or like, have you ever dealt with this person before? I'm having a bit of a headache or whatever it is, you know,
it's
just that having that honesty and that community, I think is quite important.
Like 100%. And you know what? I've had a guest on the show before, James, and he spoke, I think we were speaking about like promotions and people getting, you know, people earning more money. And I think one of the things he said is like, the reason you don't earn the big bucks when you're young is because, yeah, you don't have that like social capital, and you don't have the people who you've been on the come up with who are in those senior positions. So because you don't have that, you're not, you can't add that much value.
Yeah,
so sometimes it is like a waiting game to, you know, put in the hard graft, come up with people, and then as opportunities arise, you can start to, you know, plug each other.
In definitely. Yeah, yeah. And I think that especially applies to music and the entertainment industry. It's such like, being a good dot connector in music is such an important element of it. If you want to be in the frontline roles of like management, A&R, booking agent, or those kind of like roles, obviously with an admin role, maybe it's not as important to be out there networking and things like that. But like when you're a manager or you have to make things happen, you have to be able to call people, text people, make things happen like on a whim, and just like, okay, so-and-so wants to work with this person. Okay, I don't know them, but I'll call this guy whose person has worked with them, and then I'll figure out how to get there or get an intro or whatever it is.
That's it. And when you like describe that, like having the in, not knowing the person, it sounds like there's a lot of favors. So is it a lot of, oh, look, you get me this time, that intro, and I got you because I've got my own people that I know. Is that kind of how it
works? Yeah, definitely. And I think like, being that kind of person is so helpful, like helping people and not expecting much back. It does come back to you. Like the karma comes back. Like I've had a lot of people help me out to get to where I am. So I like to help people out when I can, like just plug people in. Okay. Meet this person, or like get in touch with this person, or whatever it is, because I had people do that for me a lot. Like I had people take a shot at me and like intro me to people. And I remember one of the first people that did it to me, I was like, why is this guy helping me out? Like I've got nothing to offer this guy. But then him doing that to me and other people in really senior positions doing that for me opened my eyes to like, okay, like you do that for other people, will come back to you. Like, and it does come back. Like it might not come back in perfect balance, but it comes back.
Yeah. And I think, just being open to that and not wanting things in return. I think just things coming back in some way is better than nothing coming back at all, if that makes sense. And I think, there's a lot of, I think sometimes people feel like, even me, like, you know, it has to be tit for tat. What's this person done for me? But when you just switch off, there are opportunities that you don't even expect that come as a result. I love that. Another thing I wanted to double click into, which you've spoken about, is that initial foot in the door. Right, you've mentioned some people, you know, took a chance on you. What is it you did to get that initial foot in the door?
So, I mean, being honest, I kind of piggybacked off what Monroe was doing. So he worked with a couple of artists early on, and then I kind of just got stuck in because I had a vested interest and like I wanted to add value. So I got stuck in. It was like a management company that would like, it was a startup management company. So I was working for free. I mean, I was working for free, and then I was like to to make money, I was like working for my uncle's flooring company. So I was like sanding floors by day and then like just editing videos or sending emails or doing whatever I had to by night or on days off or whatever. Mm-hmm. So like that got my foot in the door to some extent, but then I helped them out for a while. I kind of realized it was never going to turn into like a full-time salaried role. So then I just started aggressively reaching out to people, not aggressive on email, but like, you know what I mean? Like I was just on it, like finding emails, reaching out to people. And I reached out to someone, I think she was maybe a radio plugger, or I think it was a radio plugger. And then she was just like, I don't have a job for you, but you should meet Sarah Lockhart. And Sarah was running Rinse at the time with Genius. So I met Sarah, and then she was like, what do you want to do? And I was kind of explaining what my experience was and what I'd been involved in and what I was passionate about. And then I think she had a role free at the radio station at Rinse, and she was just kind of like, it sounds like you want to work in management. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. I don't think I even fully knew what management was at the time.
Yeah.
But I knew that I wanted to do a role that encompassed a lot of things. Like I didn't want to be stuck in a box. Like the thought of like doing PR or radio or something that was just sectioned off felt quite limiting to me. Mm-hmm. So I quite liked management because you have like a 360 view of everything. Like you have to learn a lot and understand all the different facets of what goes into building an artist or a producer. So yeah, she connected me with G, and then I ended up being an assistant at Rinse and then day-to-day manager, and I was there for a couple of years in the end. So it was like the person I reached out to wasn't directly the one that helped, but then they connected me with someone and they connected me with someone, and then I landed a job from that. So it was,
I hear that. My question is, when you reach out to people, do you have a specific technique that ensures that they're going to respond? Or is it just that aggressive outreach where you reach out to a lot of people?
I can't even remember what I would have said in those emails, honestly. I mean, I was doing, because I was still doing videography at the time. So I had that as like a value add of like, I could come in, film stuff, edit it. I was learning the basics of how the industry worked. I was keen and passionate and hardworking. So I think like, but people have to see that. They can't see that in an email. Like you have to get in front of them for them to even see a glimpse of that. So I honestly couldn't tell you what I was. If I read those emails back, I'd probably cringe like hell as well. Yeah. It would probably be so cringe. But yeah, I don't know. I think just like reaching out and like, showing that you're keen without being too keen as well. There's like, there's an extreme level to it as well, where you can just be a bit much as well, I think.
Yeah, I think to anyone who's listening to this and they're looking to get that initial foot in the door, I've listened to like Stephen Bartlett talk about it a lot. He's just had a podcast with this guy called Dan Priestley. And one of the things they look for is, yeah, like that value add or something like outside of the norm and like attention to detail. So Dan Priestley, who was on his podcast, he gave this story about how in the background of one of his videos, he had like a Stratocaster, which is like a type of guitar, and a guitar teacher reached out to him saying, hey, would love to speak to you. We'll give you some guitar lessons as well if you're interested. And it's like seeing the detail behind the detail. I know Stephen Bartlett, you know, he's previously mentioned his dog before people knew who his like dogs were, but it's seeing the detail within the detail and being able to potentially, you know, add value in that way, I think is a good outreach technique. I'm trying to implement it at the moment, you know, getting guests on this podcast. I'll let you know how it goes. You'll see if the guests improve. We'll see if the guests retain their value is what I mean.
I think probably what I was saying in those emails was probably drawing from what I'd given the startup management company that I was helping at the time, like anything, any value that I'd added during that. Cause I remember I was like filming stuff. I was helping with like PR. I remember just like putting a press release together and then getting loads of emails and then blasting them out and using learning MailChimp and stuff like that. Just like, I was probably like just packaging all those things up and saying like, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. Yeah. Like just showing that I'm resourceful.
Yeah,
you know?
100%. And I don't think some people do that. I think a lot of people, they just are like, hey, help me. And I think, yeah, you do have to be able to show that resource.
But that's the value in just getting involved in things and helping early. Like I think if you want to be a manager or involved in the music industry, that if you're young, just get involved in something. Like if your friend is on the come up, or if your friend's making a bit of music and there's ways that you can add value and figure things out for them and like research and learn and understand and like be knowledgeable or like start to be knowledgeable and feed that into someone to help them on their journey, then like it might not lead to anything directly, but the fact that you're acquiring skills when you're doing that, you know, it's like, I think it's more value than you realize when you're young and you're just like hustling and trying to figure it out. You know?
And I think what I'd add to that, if you don't know a friend who's on the come up, maybe there's a friend of a friend who's on the come up.
Yeah, definitely. And like Instagram, TikTok, like just reach out
to people. Engage with people's
content. It's so easy now. I mean, it was like, I guess it was kind of similar when I was doing it. You know, it's probably, I don't know, it's probably Facebook.
There was no TikTok back
then. It was Facebook. Facebook was the big one back then. But yeah, it's similar. Like there's a means to reach out and get involved. Even before that, the MySpace days, like people would, I mean, why can't we put music on our profiles anymore, man?
is that what you want? Yeah.
Well, yeah, bring MySpace back. Or bring some elements of MySpace back into things where you can put three tunes on your profile like that.
What were your three tunes? Do you remember?
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. Probably all three hip hop tunes.
Oh, yeah. I remember one of mine. Actually, two. One was Ray J, One Wish. I'm pretty sure another one was Neo, So Sick.
Oi, you know,
the sweet boy back in the day.
That doesn't surprise me. You know, on Bebo, do you remember Bebo? Yeah,
I've never had it. You know,
I had Bebo, and there was a section on it that was like music you like, and I must have spent like 2 hours copying every single name in my iTunes library into the thing. It was categorized. There was like 200 artist names in there.
You were trying to do SEO hacking to find like your music soul, mate.
Oh my god, I was trying to cover all bases.
Yeah. But no, you mentioned the fact that music management is like a 360 view. For the listener, how would you define the role of a music manager and what they do?
I think it's being resourceful to an artist. It's protecting an artist to some extent. Or when I say artist, I don't just mean like a music artist. I mean any creative. Like I work with producers predominantly, and songwriters and mixers. So like the last couple of years, my focus has more been on that side rather than artist side, like managing artists directly. But the same applies really. I think it's being resourceful. It's being, it's just understanding the dynamics of how it works, understanding the game, understanding people's roles, how to utilize others, learning how it works, learning what's fair remuneration for their work, and just connecting dots and like making things happen and being of service.
And as a manager, like how many producers, artists, creatives would you typically manage at a time?
It's quite dependent. It depends on like how many you're doing directly, if you've got staff, if you're working for a big company, if you're independent, whatever. I don't know. There's not a fixed amount that I could give. Like some people have wider capacity. Some people might manage like fewer but bigger clients. You might have like two big clients that take up a lot of your time. Or you might have like seven emerging clients that you're kind of betting on. You know, it's just different circumstances. I don't think there's one way to do it. I think it's just dependent on your bandwidth and also like being honest, like the actual, like the cash flow, the money that's coming in, like it's not actually easy to make money from music. You know, it's like there are a lot of revenue streams, but it's like having a moment where something pops off and becomes very successful. It can be challenging to create that. You know, it's like you've got to, it's a lot of graft. But I think like when you're analyzing who to work with as a manager, you really have to, there's so many factors that go into it. And there's so many variables that go into allowing someone to create a living out of music. Like it's not just how talented you are. It's like your application, it's your work ethic. It's a bit of luck. It's the team you put around you. It's who you associate yourself with, who you take risks on in terms of the artists that you work with. There's just like so many things, whether an artist can use social media to their advantage effectively. There's so many variables. And even as a producer, like you can, okay, even sometimes even getting a session is hard. Like with a certain artist, they might be like, might have their people, or they might just be like touring or whatever. It might be difficult to pin them down. Then when you get in the room with them, you've got to create something that they like. Then they've got to like it enough to actually put the song out. And then the song's got to come out and do well enough for you to generate money from it, which doesn't happen all the time. You know, there's something like, 100,000 songs uploaded to Spotify almost every day. You know, it's like, it's an obscene amount of music.
100,000?
Something like that. Yes, it's an obscene 60,000 uploads a day. That's or something on Spotify. It's like, it's an obscene amount of music being put out there. So it's like being able to work with someone that cuts through that noise. I'm talking like from a producer or a songwriter's perspective. It takes like a lot of weighing up, like who do you want to work with? Like, it's your time that you're risking. Like, producers generally don't get paid up front for what they do. Like, you're risking like 8 hours of your day to take a shot on someone, and there's so many factors that are out of your control. Like, you can make an amazing song and like the manager and the A&R are like, oh, just, I'm not really that keen on it, but it might be like your favorite song of that artist, even though you might be biased.
So then in that example that you've just used there, right, you're talking about the producer. In your role as the music manager, what are you doing to make sure that song is considered and not just an afterthought, and making sure that song does get pushed into production?
You can't force it ultimately. Like, that's the difficult thing. Like, you can obviously, after the session, there's usually a bounce, like a demo bounce from the session, make sure that the artist manager's got that, make sure everyone involved has got that. So it's like at least on everyone's laptops to have a shot. You know, it might be like a year in the future, and the manager's like, just listen to songs on their laptop, or the artist is, and they're like, I forgot about this tune, like, we should put this out. You know, but like, at least at a minimum, like delivering them a bounce. Like, there was a...
What is a bounce, sorry?
Like an export of the song from the session. Yeah, like not just keeping the song on a hard drive. Like, I feel like some producers early on, they might make a tune with someone and the artist might not even receive the song, because the producer might be like in their head about like, oh, I need to work on that. I need to make sure it's better, whatever. I think just like, even if it's really rough, just get a bounce out, send it to them. And like, if the idea is good, then for the most part, someone should be able to recognize that. Like, okay, let's go back in and work on the songwriting, build out the production or whatever. But like, if someone doesn't even have the song, you got no chance. Like, after 2 or 3 months, the artist isn't even going to remember that song. Yeah. Right? There's no reference point for them.
There's so many things that I wanna click into. I think the first is, you mentioned the fact that, you know, there are different types of music managers. You know, some people might have a few bigger artists, or you can have a lot of promising people. In each example, like, where is your time being taken up? Like, with the bigger artists, what is it? Why is it that you can only work with a couple, whereas with the promising artists, you can work with a lot more? What is it that consumes your time, and where is your focus in the different examples?
There's not like a fixed answer to that question, to be honest. It's like, it could be anything. And to be honest, like, managers are juggling a few clients at a time. So it's dependent on whether a client's in cycle, how much music they're putting out, whether they're touring, whether they're writing at that moment. It's so dependent on a number of factors. But
okay, so you can manage one for 3 months, he does his thing.
Yeah, but it's never quite like that. It's never completely off with anyone, you know, and that shouldn't be the case, because then it's the artist or the producer's issue for not working hard enough, you know. I think picking people to work with that are really hard workers is so important. Like, and analyzing, like, no matter what the talent is, if you're taking on a client, they have to have their own graft, and they have to have just a strong dedication to what they're doing, because it's not easy. And it doesn't, like, if you've got a producer that's going to rely on their manager to deliver everything for them on a platter, they're never going to be successful. Mm. You have to build your own relationships. You have to be like so proactive. You have to be up every day. You have to be self-motivated. It's not easy. Like, a manager's not going to create opportunities out of thin air for you. Yeah. Like, there has to be something to work with. Like, even at like a base level, like, someone might be early in their career, but then you might recognize like, okay, they're in this certain community. Like, they don't have a hit record or anything yet, but like, they're building with these people. They're making cool music. They work hard every day. They're like learning every day. They're open-minded. That's a big part of it. It's not like, and the talent, of course, is important, but the work ethic is so much more important than the talent, I think.
Yeah. Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. Yes. I stole that from, you know, my friends. But yeah, it's a big fact. All right. Just going into that even further, for you as a music manager, you've mentioned the work ethic. How is it that you win business and yet producers that want to partner with you?
I mean, just being able, I mean, it's the value proposition, really. You know, it's like, what can you offer them? How do they fit within your roster? Like, sometimes you might have, like, you don't want your roster to clash either. Like, if you have two things that are really similar, you have two producers that are in exactly the same lane, at some point, one of them is going to feel like you're favoring one of them or something. You know, you're going to have to put, you might have one opportunity for two people and you're going to have to put it one way. So, like, I think having a roster that's well balanced, like they sort of sit in slightly different pockets. Yeah, diversified.
S&P 500.
Exactly. Yeah. Get that index fund. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Index fund of artists.
Yeah, I think that, but like, I don't know. It's just, it's a value proposition. It's also like, it's very like character and personality driven. Like, you have to get on with someone. Like, it's very, the lines blur a lot between like business and personal. Like, I think people you work with, you have to be able to get on with them very well. Like, probably spend a lot of time with them on the phone, texting them every day, like sending opportunities their way,
as
communicating.
Before you're their manager, or is this like?
I think there's a process before you're a manager as well where that happens. But like when you're in like a manager client relationship, if you want to call it that, it's like it's very like intertwined. Like you're talking with them every day, pretty much, about like opportunities, trying to make sure that your understanding of where they're at, like what they want to work on, what their headspace is, like just how they want to move their career forward, like what artists they want to work with, what they like and what they don't like. Other people they like collaborating with. It's just, yeah, there's so many factors that go into it. But then also it's like, it's about having a bit of a vision for them. Just dot connecting again, like making sure that there's progress like every week, every day and every week you're making like some sort of progress, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. In that, what would you say is the most challenging aspect of being a music manager?
I think when it comes to managing producers, it's probably trying to land them like in big impactful sessions that are going to make a difference on their career. I feel like recently in the music industry, it's been a bit harder in that case. And I talked to a lot of other managers, and even like, it really comes from, I think the record labels are struggling right now to identify talent and sign the right talent. You know, it's like going back to what I said earlier about there being so much music uploaded, it's hard to know like what horse to bet on, if you want to phrase it like that. It's like there's so much music coming out, and because of TikTok, you never know when something's going to pop. Like, even analyzing data to an extent won't help you, because someone might have like 10,000 monthly listeners on Spotify right now today that in a year's time could be doing crazy numbers.
But you can't, like Tyler with Water.
That's yeah. Yeah, you can't see it at the time. Like, it's in hindsight, it seems easy, but it's not.
Yeah.
So you have to analyze a lot of things. So I think the hardest thing is like finding compelling sessions where you can like really feel like, okay, you should 1000% do that session. It's going to benefit your life. Ultimately, you're lining people up with sessions where you are taking a bit of a bet. You're like, could go either way.
What? So you feel like at the moment there are people who, when you're booking a session, you just don't know, I suppose, like you don't know if it's Messi or Ronaldo, or if it's like Adebayo Akinfenwa or someone like that. It's like, you know they're a footballer.
You don't know what league they're going to end up in.
You don't know how many Ballon d'Ors they've got, if they've got any.
You don't know what league they're going to go up in, wow. end up in and at how, all.
Okay, so...
You might end up spending 6 months of your life with an artist that ends up in the conference. Never makes you any money. It's a reality.
But in that example where you spend 6 months with them and they don't make you any money, what would you say is like the main determining factor for that? And the reason I ask that is like, if we use the football analogy, if I watch someone play football for 6 months, I can tell you whether they're fucking shit or not. You know what I mean? Like, why is it that it takes you 6 months in the music industry? And maybe it's like a different, it's like apples and pears.
I don't think it's a comparison that's as clear cut, because I think in music, like there's such a spread of talent. And also like, I think you can land on something, you can make something one day that's just like such, you're just like capturing magic in a bottle, and like you might never capture that magic again, but like if you're there in the room and you helped an artist make it, even if it's a one-hit wonder, you're gonna get paid.
Yeah.
Like it's, I think everyone's motivation working in music, I think if you're ambitious, is like everyone's just like just on a hustle to find that thing that's going to change their life. If you're a producer or whatever, you're just like, you're trying to find something that's going to make like a real impact, not only financially either, like it's going to fulfill you like creatively. I think that's such a hard balance to make, and it's a bit of a head fuck for people, because you're like, oh, I need to be able to pay the bills and whatever, but then you don't want to be like,
you don't want to sell out,
you don't want to spend like 2 months making children's music for, yeah. You know, if you want to be like having Billboard hits or whatever, it's just like it just feels like you're not going in a path that's going to fulfill you.
Yeah, I hear that. So this might be like a difficult question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You know, you've mentioned catching lightning in a bottle. Like, what would you put in place to increase the likelihood that you catch that lightning in a bottle?
I mean, it's about analyzing talent that's out there. Like, you, for me, working with producers, it's a dialogue on like, are you into this? Like, are you passionate about it? I think like when you're a producer getting into a room or weighing up whether you should work with an artist, it's like that borderline feeling of like the baseline feeling of being passionate about something that you're, well, passionate about an artist that you're about to work with, mm-hmm. and understanding of what they do, it's going to help,
okay.
You know. But I don't know, there's other factors like, you know, who's the manager, who's the team, who's the label, who are the other people involved in the project. Like there's other factors that can weigh into it, whether it's like a good idea or not. But also like sometimes you might turn down an opportunity because you don't like other variables that are involved, and ultimately sometimes that they don't even matter. You might have a manager that's like never managed anything in their life, but it doesn't mean that they can't.
Mm. Everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah, it's not, I don't think, like I think a lot of producer managers, and I try and veer away from it, they analyze an artist and they're like, okay, how experienced is the manager? Sometimes I don't think that it's valid
100%.
As much, because if you look at certain artists that have blown up in the last like 5-10 years, like some of their managers are just like they're boys,
yeah.
Or they're friends that they've grown up with, and they've been so like, you know, much like me and Monroe, they've been so like passionate about helping them that they'll do whatever it takes to like learn and figure it out and
become
like
who they need to
support
be.
Them and become the manager that their friend needs. So yeah, I don't know. It depends. It depends. There's too many variables to weigh up for sure, whether an idea is whether an artist is worthy of working with or not. You just have to take the bet sometimes.
I hear that. And I like the fact that you just used the phrase take the bet, because, you know, you mentioned the fact that you can work with someone for 6 months and there'd be no positive financial outcome as a result. As a music manager, like, you know, we had Monroe on, like you said, and, you know, we spoke about publishing deals and recoup and this and that. How is it that you get remunerated? Like, how does their success equal your success?
So most managers basically are on a 20% commission. Okay. on what your artist, producer, songwriter makes. So yeah, it's based on that. I think at the higher level, you know, when you have like superstar artists, the commission, you know, maybe goes down to like 15% or whatever, but
all right, 15% of a few mil, I'll take it. You know what I mean?
but yeah, essentially you're making 20% of what they earn. So I mean, breaking down the economics of being a manager, yeah, you can imagine how hard that is to make a living, right? It's not easy to make money from music in the first place. So you're thinking like, if you get $100,000 deal for your artist, that sounds like, wow, you've got $100,000 deal on the table, but you're making $20,000 from that deal, and then you got to pay your tax on it, and then or whatever else they've got. And even from an artist perspective or a producer's perspective, like, okay, from that deal they'll make $80,000, right? But then they've got to pay their lawyer, they've got to pay their taxes, all of that stuff. There's a lot of it can get diluted quite quickly, that kind of money. And so also you can't survive on $20,000 a year as a manager. Like you need to be generating like a decent amount of money for your clients just to keep afloat.
And then also like with that, so thanks first of all for being that open. I feel like in order to generate some of these opportunities, there might have to be some, you know, you might just have to book the studio or book this, book that. It all takes money, right? Mm-hmm. And that's money where if you're not generating income, it might be coming out of your pocket or your artist's pocket, but you're feeling that on the back end as well.
Yeah, definitely. That's another gamble you have to take if you have to pay for that yourself and take a bet on it. A lot of the time, if the song gets used and they've got a label that's a major label or like any sort of like funding, then you can recharge the studio to the label for the most usually. Mm-hmm. But then most producers have their own studio and like they're using their own space to make music for other people. I think like
the you got to chip into the Lecky bill, you know them.
No, you know what I mean? They should. But I think the people, being honest, the people that get the worst deal out of anyone in music are songwriters. Like really? They get dealt the worst hand. It's like, think about it as a songwriter, yeah? You have to pay for yourself to be at the studio. Like you're paying your train fare or your petrol in your car to get to the studio. Yeah. Then like I was saying earlier, then you've got to create an environment in the room where you can get a good song. Song's got to be good enough for the artist to like it. The artist and their team and the A&R and whoever else is involved has to like the song enough to want to put it out. Then the song has to come out. And then the song has to be extremely successful if you're only a songwriter to make any money. If you're a producer, at least you can charge a production fee. You can get a royalty on the master side. Like as a songwriter, it's starting to change, but you can't usually get a royalty on the record side. You only get a royalty on the publishing side. And to make money from publishing, a song has to stream a lot, or it has to go on radio, or it has to sync really well. Like it's tough. Like if you think about a song that's maybe got like, say it's got 100 million streams. Mm-hmm. So it's about, say it's got 10 million streams, right? It's about roughly about £4,000 for a million streams.
Is it?
And that's, and so we'll say around 5,000 on like, if it's in a territory that's paying the maximum amount of Spotify, like if it's a big difference between getting streamed in like the US or the UK and getting a stream in like Venezuela or India, because they don't pay the same rate. So, you know, based on like the average incomes in those economies, like that people in India might be paying like £3 a month for Spotify, yeah, whereas we're paying like 12 or whatever it is. Yeah. So, but if you've got a song that does a million streams in a high paying territory, the whole piece of the pie is maybe £5,000, right? And out of that £5,000, 4,000 goes to the master side. So that's the recording side of the copyright, yeah?
Oh my God.
Only 1,000 goes to the composition, the songwriting side. So if you're a songwriter and say you've written a song that does a million streams, yeah? And you've done it with a producer and an artist. So there's three people that have written the song. The producer's written the music. The artist has written some of the top line and the songwriter has like helped with lyrics and melody and stuff. So you might get like 33.3% if you split the publishing evenly, the 100% of the publishing, right? So it's done a million streams. Out of that £5,000, there's 1,000 for songwriters. You're getting £333 for a song that's done a million streams in a high streaming territory. Imagine. And it takes...
In Nigeria, we go, yeah, mugwe. Hey!
Obviously there's a lot of examples where songs are very successful and you can make a lot of money, but like even getting to a million streams for a lot of songs, it's not a given. It's not a given at all. So as a songwriter, like you're taking a big gamble with your time. Like, so it's tough on them right now.
Would you propose?
Well, they're starting to get points on the master side, which means that if a song does well, they can earn from the recording element of the copyright.
Why is it so lopsided as well that it's 80% on the publishing side and...
On the record side. So it's more leaning towards the record side. I honestly don't know. I think it's just the mechanics of how the industry was built and like how it used to be back in the day. I think there's a lot of movements to try and change that and readdress the balance. But the argument against that is that a lot of the major recording companies own the major publishing companies, so they don't really have as much of an incentive to change it because they're getting paid either way, you know.
So this might sound like a stupid question, but for me, I feel like a lot of songwriters, they'll be like musicians or they'll be singers. So are there a lot of like songwriter only types out there who were really impacted?
Not as many as there should be, because a lot of them ultimately can't pay their bills and have to like get a 9 to 5. Yeah, yeah. Right. Which is a shame because there's a lot of talented people out there that just can't afford to make a living from music. But there's some amazing top line writers, lyric writers, melody writers that's their sole job. Especially when you go to places like LA, which is like the entertainment hub of the world, really. There's a lot of people that specialize in lyric or specialize in melody, and they'll go in and just lay down melody lines or just help with lyrics solely. And like, you know, you can build a room around those elements for an artist.
The music game is so crazy. And Leah, like you said, like it's a bit of a gamble, isn't it? You got a bit on the
such
right
a gamble
horse.
Yeah, there's so many variables involved in a song or an artist being big or being impactful, you know.
And then just to come back to it, like managing a big artist, if somebody starts off right, you know, you start off with your up and comers, how is it you get the opportunity to work with a Taylor Swift, with an Adele? You know, you mentioned the fact that a lot of people, their managers are people who have come with them from the come up. I know that sometimes when an artist gets really big, you need somebody who has that experience, right, of being there, done that, stadium, world tour, this and that. How do you become that manager? Like who's at the top of the tree, Jose Mourinho or Pep Guardiola. Like when the big artist gets signed to a label, they're going to get you. Like you work for the label, right? How does it work typically?
Nah, you don't work for the label as a manager.
Oh,
the label works for you, mate. Okay. Nah, it's not true. I think as a manager, it's your responsibility to assemble a team around the artist that can deliver across the board, really. So a lot of managers, they get in those positions where you're managing those huge acts. They've probably built one from the ground up themselves and learned it on the job and had an artist that's like had that belief in them, and they've had that partnership where they've been able to build it. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a lot of examples of that.
Scooter Braun with Bieber.
Scooter Braun, yeah, is a good example. Adele's manager, Jonathan Dickens, from day one managed her. So it's like
that's just lucky, isn't it? Like
I don't think it is.
Well, not lucky, but like to your point, if you're adding value to someone like Adele from day one, just the fact that you know Adele, the fact that you live near Adele or went to school with Adele and caught her singing on lunch break.
Nah, there's a lot of ways to fuck it up though. There's a lot of ways to fuck it up.
Yeah, but like you've got something to fuck up. Do you get what I mean?
But there's so many ways to fuck it up. I think the best managers, like they really, they have such an alignment with the artist in terms of understanding what they want to do, and they have a shared vision and they have like a relentless graph to make it happen. And they also they're not only managing the artist, they're managing everyone around the artist. Like you're analyzing like, okay, who's the best record label to go with? Like this record label offered us $1 million, this one's offering us $100,000, but like that doesn't mean that the million is the better deal to do than the $100,000. It's like who's in their team, what have they got about them, what are you signing away, like where does it, and also like with artists in particular, the positioning and the credibility is so important. Like there's so many, I think it's very easy to go for the jugular and be like, okay, let's try and have a hit, we'll figure it out. But you can fuck it up for the artist. And am I allowed to swear as much?
Yeah, you know, YouTube will let me know. Yeah, it's cool.
You can just not subtitle it. You just have to blank out a subtitle. Having an eye for positioning is very important, and an eye for credibility and like picking artists that are authentic to what they do. Mm-hmm. Because I think authentic artists are going to be, they're artists that have the potential to become career artists if certain things fall in place. Whereas like there's certain artists where it's tough to have that full, there's so many things that have to go into career artists, like their work ethic for one, but also their vision and authenticity and their ability to build with an audience and connect with people is so important. But yeah, I don't know. I think like those big artists
So what it sounds like is the artists have become, the artists and the managers, they almost need each other just as much to get to those levels, right? Yeah. Because maybe Adele wouldn't be Adele without Mr. Dickens, as you said. I call him. What was his name? Jonathan Dickens. Mm. Or, you know, maybe Bieber wouldn't have been Bieber without Scooter, like taking him. It's basically what you're saying. They need it, the artist and the manager need each other to thrive.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. 100%. Like a manager can build their career off having a successful act if they've done it in the right way. And then like you're saying about how do you get to that point of like having a whole roster of acts like that? Like that act that you bring through and take to the very top becomes a very easy calling card for artists that get to a certain level and feel like maybe it's not working out with their manager, or for whatever reason they've parted ways with their manager, and then they're looking at like that guy's just got that person to stadiums in 4 years and whatever, like I should go with them. And then they're like, they probably earn enough money at that point to like be building out staff and taking on new clients and like diversifying what they're working on and applying what they've learned with that artist to other artists. And you know, like managers, like at that level, well, managers' job is to be resourceful, no matter what, like where you are on the spectrum of it, what tier you're in. You know, it's like,
mate, as I hear you talk, you sound, you know, very passionate about like music and, you know, music management, and you obviously, you know, you stand on that hill. What brings you the most joy from being a music manager?
I like the element of educating people about things and like people understanding what they're getting into. I do like like being able to just like share things and for people to have that understanding of like what, because I've taken it upon myself to be quite hands-on, especially when it comes to like contracts and like learning them. Like I remember in my first job, there was like a, I shouldn't even be saying this. There was
a, no, this is what we do.
There was a contract, I think, on like a box folder, or maybe it got sent to me in an email or something. And I like saved it to my computer and I just looked through the whole contract. Like it was a recording contract and I looked through the whole thing. And then I was researching like, what is a mechanical royalty? Like, what does this word mean? Like what do all these phrases mean? And then even to the point where like managing producers and managing Monroe, like looking at producer deals and like having an understanding of what's in them, I think it serves you well as a manager to not be like naive about that stuff.
Would you want to manage an artist who goes on like a big world tour?
It's not really in my ambition right now. I feel like I've found a place in the industry that I really like a pocket that I really like.
And what is that place and pocket?
It's actually somewhere in between management and A&R, pretty much.
What's like, A&R, sorry?
Artist and repertoire. So you're involved in like finding talent, signing it, developing it, being a dot connector, plugging them in certain rooms, whatever. Make it help. It's got a different meaning depending on what side you sit on, because there's a record label A&R and a publishing A&R, and they're slightly different roles. Like if you're an A&R in the publishing world, you're signing songwriters. So you're signing people that have shares on compositions. And songwriters can include producers, because for the most part, producers are songwriters as well, because they write the music that goes into the production for the most part. There's obviously producers that take something that someone else has written and then produce it up. And that's like maybe more of an old school producer that would get in the studio with a bunch of musicians and build out from what a songwriter's done. Mm-hmm. But nowadays there's a lot of like hybrid producer songwriters that like create the chords themselves and then build out the production. So a publishing A&R sits on the side where you're signing songwriters and you're trying to work with songwriters and producers and give them opportunities. So I'd say on the publishing A&R side, your role is more as a dot connector. Like you're trying to connect people, get them in the right rooms. If you've got a producer or a songwriter, obviously in an ideal world, if they're early in their career and they can get in the room with Beyonce, like and create a song that becomes a hit, then the publishing company or you are going to make a lot of money. So like that's the ideal goal for that. But then on the record side as an A&R, you're trying to find artists and like you're trying to find that talent. So the analysis of what you're looking for is different. Like on the publishing side, you're just trying to find someone that can like create stuff for artists. But on the record side, you're trying to find an artist that, or a song that you can sign the record side to that will become a big record.
Bloody hell, mate. It's a lot.
On the A&R side, on the record side as well, like you're managing a few more people, I think. Like there's more variables to it in some way, because you're like, you might sign an artist, but then you're not only signing an artist, you've got to make sure that you're like delivering the records into the label, and the label are passionate enough to promote them and back them. So you've got to sell it to the marketing team. Like, we've got a new single coming this week. You know, you get on board, do what you can or whatever, try and engage the team. But then also you're involved in actually like making the records and finishing the records. So it might be like you go in the studio, they've got the project to a certain place. Then you're like, okay, I know a producer that can maybe do some additional production on this to like take it to that level. And then you've got to get all the songs mixed and mastered and finished to that level in agreement with the artist and their team, where everyone's like happy with the final sound recording. So it's not just about the song and the underlying composition. It's about like the final piece that goes out.
So this might sound like a silly question, but it sounds like you need to know a bit about how music sounds. And you also got to be able to communicate in a way if you don't feel like it's finished.
Yeah.
So you come with a solution, right? It mm-hmm. might not be the finished article, but I know somebody who might be able to elevate this piece of or this body of work.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit more hands-on in the process when you're on the record side. You know, yeah. you're a bit more, it's your responsibility to, you're ultimately managing the product that comes out on services. So you have to, you know, be involved in that process from start to finish. And sometimes it varies for different artists. Some artists are very hands-on with that themselves. So maybe you don't have to do as much, but you know, on the publishing side, you don't have to finish a record for anyone.
Okay. You know? Okay. Mate, it sounds like, you get stuck in and it seems like you do a lot. A question I love to ask my guests, do you have any productivity hacks?
You know what? I always find it better when I can map out my whole day, like on my calendar. That's definitely a productivity hack that serves me well. Sometimes I forget it and I get a bit like lost in the sauce and a bit reactive. and then like I'll finish the week and then like on a Sunday, I'm like, let me just plan out my day almost to the minute tomorrow. Like last night before I went to bed, I put in my calendar like, you know, 6:30, wake up, 7 o'clock, eat breakfast, like shower at this time, leave at this time, get to like, I work from a coffee shop today, get to the mm-hmm. coffee shop at this time. And then it was like, email this person, like follow up with this meeting, all of it like plugged in. So I have like something to follow. So I'm not just like endlessly reacting to stuff. Mm-hmm. That's something that, I think took me a while to learn and is such a good thing to know across all industries, is like you can just end up being quite reactive to your inbox and actually doesn't serve you that well being overly reactive.
Yeah, like you need to be organized, right? I think organization leads to proactivity because you have dedicated time where you can think about things. Like I was listening to someone on a podcast this weekend and they spoke about having 3 notepads, and like one notepad is for internal business stuff. The next notepad is for external meetings. The third notepad is just like general thoughts. And, you know, based on the notepad where he was jotting down, he knew like the compartment of his brain where he needed to like allocate that time and resource, and it allowed him to be a lot more productive. So right. Yeah, by being organized and knowing what you're doing at specific times, it allows you to put all of your brain power into the task you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. No, I find that super helpful. Even down to like, if I'm working from home, it's like, cool, 6:30, cook dinner. Yeah. I'll put all of that in.
Yeah.
That helps me just like structure my day. Cause I think I'm a structure person. I always try and like think about the difference between routine and structure. Like, I don't think I'm a routine person. Mm-hmm. I don't do the same thing at the same time every day. I think I would get so bored. I don't like, no day looks the same to me ever. I don't do the same thing at the same time every day. I'd hate that so much.
Really?
Yeah. I just don't think it suits the way that I approach work.
Yeah, I hear that.
But like, I definitely have a morning routine. I guess you could call it a morning routine though, but I don't necessarily do it at the same time. It's dependent on like, if I've been working late, if I've been out at a gig, like I don't wake up at the same time every day either. Like this morning I was up at 6:30. Some mornings I'm up at 8:30. It's like, it's so different depending on.
You get the sleep where you can.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But I have the same routine in the morning that like really helps get me in gear. Like I've sort of like, have you read Atomic Habits?
Yeah, I have. James Clear. Yeah, big book.
Big fan of that book. I like how it it sort of makes habits very manageable and like makes them realistic and like breaks down like the keys behind habits. So I created a morning routine with all of that in mind. And like I've managed to be so consistent with it. Because I remember like, I'm not good at like, if I join a gym, I'll be consistent for like 3 weeks and then I'll just fall off a cliff with the consistency.
Yeah.
I'm so bad. I'm just like, I'll just go out every now and then I get swamped with work and then I'm just like, I'll go tomorrow and then goes back. But like with this, I've managed to like create a hybrid of like workout yoga in the morning where I kind of do a bit of both in a very short time span and then read, like I have two books at the moment that I read like one page each and then Sick. Write some notes and then I start my day.
Sick.
No phone. Yeah. Sick.
And I think, you know, one of the things I took from Atomic Habits, and I think I said it on this podcast before, it's just about reframing stuff. And reframing it increases like the likelihood of you making the habit consistent. And the example that was used in the book or that I use is like, rather than saying, oh, it's 6:30, like it's so early to go to the gym. It's like you reframe it as today I'm going to make myself healthier.
Yeah,
and it's like just having a little reframe, it goes a long way into creating habits.
I think reading Atomic Habits like actually opened my eyes to like how much I was already doing or how much I was almost there with stuff that I wasn't quite like closing on or like being consistent with. But I think I sort of reframed over the last like maybe 5-8 years, like reframe my thoughts on food as well. Like I eat quite healthy. Mm. And I think I've like learned how to enjoy healthy foods more than like junk foods or fried. I don't like junk foods, but I have McDonald's maybe like twice a year. And every time after I finish it, I'm like, why did I do that?
Horrible.
Like, horrible.
You know, you mentioned eating healthy. Do you feel like that has led to like more productivity with work?
Yeah, definitely. Is it because on the odd day that I do wake up late and I just like scrap a breakfast together, I don't know. It always makes me feel a bit like shit about myself. And then I have to try and like work my way out of that. Whereas like, I usually make overnight oats. I make overnight oats, loads of fruit, nuts in there, stuff.
Yeah. You know, something I found in my work is I used to snack a lot. I still fall off the wagon sometimes to snack. But yeah, like when you don't have like chocolate bars, cookies, crisps, I feel like I have more energy. Like people who have worked with me, they will have seen me like fall asleep late in the afternoon, like at my desk, or if there's like a company all hands or something, I'm like rocking to and fro. But like when you don't snack and you just eat like good meals, you actually have so much more energy and
hydration
like,
as well.
Yeah, like when you understand that, you're like, oh damn, like
yeah
I can do a lot more here if I just improve my diet a little bit.
I'm on a snap out of that recently. I've just snapped out of that phase.
Yeah.
Because I'm chocolate is my enemy, man. I love it so much. Yeah. But like I've been trying to reframe my brain from like when I see a chocolate bar, I'm like, because I was also reading, I can't remember what book it is, but I was reading about how dopamine reacts in the brain. And like dopamine is actually released, I think I'm getting this right. I don't want to sound like an expert. I'm not an expert. Yeah, disclaimer.
Yeah.
But I think dopamine is actually released around the thought of something, not when you've completed something. Okay. So like the thought of having a chocolate bar is more exciting to your brain than actually finishing the chocolate bar and being like, oh, I'm so happy I ate that or whatever. It's actually like the dopamine release comes before. So if you can train your brain of like the thought is more enjoyable than the outcome, that's the way to approach it. That's what tries to get me on the straight and narrow.
Gets you back on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
We took a big digression there.
We did.
To talk about health.
I love all that stuff.
One thing that I've wanted to ask about all session is, you know, you've mentioned the fact that as a music manager, you deal with a lot of different people, right? And you've got to make things happen. Talk to me about like your approach to building and nurturing relationships and maybe like some key bits of advice you have for people who might be struggling to build and nurture relationships.
I think communication is really underrated. I don't think I've mentioned that so far, actually. That's like such an important part of being in my role and like being in the music industry in general, being able to communicate effectively and just have good communication skills, be able to like... My whole job really is communication. I'm like speaking with a lot of people. I'm gathering information. I'm relaying that information into the people that need to know about it. Finding out about things, about projects that maybe my guys should be involved in or whatever. So I think that's massive. Following up is massive. Like, I definitely take pride. I'm not perfect, but I definitely take pride in being someone that like follows up and tries to create actionable points from every meeting, if there are ones to be had. Like, if I sit down with someone and we talk about ideas, I used to do it early in my career where I would just be too floaty with it. Like, I'd talk about ideas and they would never happen because I would never do anything about them, or I would rarely do anything about them. But I think like as you develop and get more experience, you understand the importance of having actionable steps to staff. I mean, it applies to every career, I'm sure, but like
100%.
Just being able to have a meeting, for me, it helps when I do it. Also, note-taking, I'm an avid note-taker. When I'm on calls, I don't usually do too many calls on the fly. Like, or I hate doing calls in the car because I can't take notes. So I usually do calls like at my desk with my notes up, and I'll be noting down everything, like everything, even the name of someone's dog if they mention it. And then if I call them up again, it's like, yo, how's little Bobby the dog? Whatever, you know, it's like, it makes such a difference, I think. To it
allows you that soft knowledge.
Yeah, I think so. But also to reference, like later down the line, like someone might mention an artist to me, like, have you heard of this artist? I'm like, sure, someone's mentioned that to me. And then I'm like, go back on my notes and I'm like, oh yeah, but I spoke to the manager. Like, I know the manager. And then, you know, if I'm interested in it, then I can hit them up or call them or whatever. So I definitely think note-taking, I definitely think following up with actionable steps from what was discussed. Those are two of the big keys, I would say.
Sick.
Yeah.
Love it. We're getting towards the end of this part of the podcast. I think just a final few couple of questions. First one is like to any aspiring, you know, music managers and people who want to get into the industry, what would your key piece of advice be to them?
Network. Just get yourself out there, help people, or help artists, whatever you want to do, like just help out. Don't put too much emphasis on like the end goal too quickly. Just get stuck in, basically. Learn how to communicate well, learn how to build relationships, and just stack up on knowledge. Like, understand how things work. Like, understand what record labels do, what publishing companies do, what the different roles are, who adds value to what. Because then I think you get an understanding of like how you can build a team, and also you can get understanding of like what you want to go into. Like, you might recognize something that you didn't even know existed and realize that it works to your strengths within your personality and how you work. So I think just learn. Like, there's so many resources online. You can find out everything theoretically about the music industry online. But
YouTube?
Yeah, YouTube. I mean, just Googling stuff, like Googling how things work.
There's what is a mechanical royalty?
What is a composition? Yeah. What's the difference between a composition copyright and a master copyright? And all that stuff.
It's like even easier now with ChatGPT.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
exactly.
Like, you can just ask ChatGPT and it will spit out like the real answer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now there's a lot of information out there. But like I say, all the information is out there on a theoretical level, but you'll learn twice as much by just being out in the field and putting it into practice, or trying to put it into practice and making mistakes and messing things up and learning from them and going back to the drawing board and losing clients and whatever. There's a whole journey to go on. It's just got to embrace the journey, embrace where you're at.
Learning comes by doing.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, just talking about ChatGPT there, are there any like emerging trends in the music industry? Like, you know, you've seen like the AI produced songs from like Drake and people. What are the trends you're noticing, and are they good for music?
I mean, AI, massive trend right now. I can't say I'm like the most plugged up about it. I read about it and I still think I've got a lot to learn. I think the biggest, one of the biggest challenges right now is AI to the music industry. And I think it's the biggest challenge and probably the biggest opportunity as well. Depends on what angle you look at it from, really. I do think it's a threat in some ways, because it's kind of scary how well voices can be replicated, you know? And I think that there's not really a law based around using someone's voice for your advantage as like a, as so say if you're like a producer artist or a producer DJ and you put out a tune and you put it through an AI tool and make it sound like Rihanna, and then you put the tune out and it sounds like Rihanna, like,
but you slightly like edited her voice so it's not Rihanna, it's like someone else.
Yeah, but it's like, it sounds like Rihanna, it's not quite her. Like the familiarity in that is gonna, it probably gonna make the song more popular than it would be otherwise. So like you're using Rihanna's likeliness to give yourself a leg up. But I don't, as far as I know, in the law, there's not a law against that. So if you wrote the song yourself and produced it yourself, there's no, and you didn't sample her composition or her master recording, then technically you haven't done anything wrong. But it's like morally, that's a dangerous place. Like, I'm sure Rihanna's team do not want people just like taking her voice and using it for their own advantage. So there's like a long way to go in terms of like being able to create a law that makes sense around that. But also on the flip side, there's so much stuff, you know, creatively that, you know, producers and artists are going to be able to lean in on.
Secure the bag by any means necessary.
Yeah.
Rihanna, don't kill me. No, this has been sick. Mark, like, picture yourself in the next 5 and 10 years. Like, where do you see yourself? What are you hoping to achieve?
I think just continuing to help creatives, like in whatever capacity that might be, continuing to be able to like educate people around me about the music industry. I don't know exactly what it looks like. And sometimes I prefer it that way. You know, I'm like, I don't have like a defined destination for 5 years or 10 years. I actually prefer recently, the way me and Monroe have been working recently is actually planning quarter by quarter rather than the whole year. And I think it's quite effective in like just moving through things and not feeling like the final destination is so far away that it becomes like not motivating.
Make it smaller, manageable.
Yeah. Smarter. Just like being able to like, okay, what do we want to achieve in 3 months? Cause you can see that. And obviously like there's an end goal to it. Like there are like things we want to achieve in a year and 2 years and whatever. But I don't know, like bit by bit, just building, being able to help people and add value to people, to creatives' careers is really what I just want to continually do over the next few years and wherever that may take me. Continue to work within the A&R and management folds, like learn how to be better at what I do. And like, one of my favorite things about my job is just being a dot connector, like being able to plug people in, whether I directly benefit from it or not. It's like I was saying earlier, I think the karma comes back. Like there's so many people that I'll just plug in and be like, oh, you should meet this person because I feel like you would offer value to this.
Do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like you might be ready to start managing some podcasters, you know? I'm hearing dot connections.
Let's talk
you get
about
me.
It, bro.
You get
Let's
me.
Talk
dots,
about it.
Dots being connected. No, I'm joking, man. Bro, this has been such a sick conversation. I don't typically do this, but I feel like there's like so much knowledge that isn't widely shared with the music industry. Do you think there's anything I've missed? Is there anything that you want the listener to really take away from this episode that we've not covered? I'm putting you on the spot. I don't normally do that.
Music industry knowledge. I'm trying to think. I mean, we've kind of covered like record labels, publishers. I don't know.
I've covered it. The bases have been covered.
I mean, I look after producers, so maybe that, you know, there's some knowledge on that side that I can share in terms of how that works. I mean, like when you're a producer and you produce a record for someone, there's like a number of ways to do it. But if the artist is on a major label, you'd usually get a fee or an advance that can be recoupable against the income of the track, oftentimes. So it might be like, say you got a £4,000 advance, that's recoupable against their income from the song. And then, I mean, so the basis of what you want to look out for as a producer is like, make sure if there's a major label involved, make sure you're getting paid a fee or an advance. Make sure you're getting points, like 3 or 4 points is about average.
Is that percent?
Percentage points, yeah. And then, If you've co-written the song, make sure you've got publishing on the song. Make sure if it's just you and the artist, it's usually 50-50. And then if there's other people involved, you can cut it up in different ways. I guess, yeah, maybe that.
That's right. That's it. No, I'll put you on the spot. We do have a quick fire round.
Let's go.
You ready?
Ready.
All right. I've made new questions for this, by the way. New. We're going to start a new, we're going to start a new segment of Quickfire. So
let's go.
You ready? Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Would you rather travel to the past or future? It's Quickfire, mate.
Fuck. Past.
Favorite artist right now?
Monroe.
Okay, sick, sick. Okay, but now the next one. Favorite artist on the come up that everyone should know about?
Moyo. M-O-I-O.
M-O-I-O.
All caps.
Okay, yeah. Sick. Would you rather manage a high profile established artist or a promising newcomer?
Neither right now. Just focusing on my producers and okay, writers okay. and mixers.
Favorite book?
The Alchemist.
Okay, sick. If you had to pick one music genre to listen to for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Probably hip hop.
Probably. That means hip hop. You listening to any good podcasts at the moment?
I mean, Diary of a CEO is always my go-to.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a bait one, but I like that one. What's the Modern Wisdom? Yeah. I dip into that one a little bit. Yeah, I like that one. Yeah, a few bait ones, to be honest. Okay. But I like those ones.
Nice. And then finally, who has it easier? Men or women?
Men.
Look at that. No hesitation. Mark, bro, thank you so much for today. We do have a closing tradition on this podcast. So knowing everything you know now and with everything that you've been through, what advice would you give your younger self? And would you still be doing the same thing?
I mean, don't go to uni. Just cut to the chase. Cut to the chase.
Okay. Bro, thank you. I mean, where can people find you?
At mark.anstey on Instagram.
Okay.
That's it. That's
it. We don't need to plug
I'm
to
not you. Really yeah, on TikTok. Like, I'm on TikTok to pre other people. I'm not really.
Make sure
TikTok,
you're following like. This podcast, you know what I mean?
Yes. Follow my boy.
Come on. Guys, if you've gotten to this point in the show, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, share, comment, let us know your thoughts. What other roles do you want to hear about? Mark, thank you so much for today, bro. This has been such a sick conversation.
Of course, man.
This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.